Just thinking before, Paul's advice to Timothy was preach the gospel in season and out of season. I think we're out of season now. It's a funny circumstance. I want to pick up that Exodus reading we had this morning. I've watched it for weeks coming towards me. And through the weeks, the circumstances have changed. It's always a significant Lenten reading, but just layer upon layer grew as the day came. I began adult life studying the social sciences in the late 1970s. That's a long time ago. And later I moved to Bible studies, theology, and then became a pastor. One of the things I've realized over the years is that social sciences, so psychology, social psychology, sociology, those sorts of things, devise new words to describe what the Bible was describing thousands of years ago. It's very interesting. If you make a new fandangled term, it sells books, but if you read your Bible, it's there already. The wisdom is awesome. The readings we had today from Exodus and John's Gospels are good examples. And they come in Lent, I believe, because as I've been saying through Lent, we need mirrors. Mirrors so we can reflect on ourselves. Who's been to Versailles, the Hall of Mirrors? It's worth going there. Apparently, it started something in European culture because for the first time, people could see themselves in large form rather than looking at a little handheld mirror. Here was this hall of mirrors, and the self-awareness and the awareness of themselves in groups was stimulated by this. That reflection is not just an idle pursuit. That reflection is for us in Lent and for us as people who are about repenting and believing, is and it helps us in addressing what needs to be addressed. So the book of Exodus, to me, is a hall of mirrors. It's a hall of mirrors for any group of people on a faith journey, like a church. They are us. We are them. And what happens on that journey over the years, people, it rings so familiar in the life of church. There is a salvation experience and then 40 years of working out how to be God's saved people. There is release from slavery and then 40 years of learning how to be God's people with a human pastor. There is a process of transition from one way of life and a founding pastor to a new way of life with a second pastor, Moses to Joshua. And as you read the stories, and a lot of them aren't pretty, they're familiar. The story we heard this morning from Exodus 17 is a typical example of what I've said so far. So, the big word that social psychologists in recent decades use to describe what people want most is homeostasis. It's Greek. Homeo as in similar, status as in being. It's what our bodies want. Our bodies want a situation where all the organs are balanced and at ease with each other. The pond is calm. A relatively stable equilibrium between interdependent elements, whether it's our body, the organs in our body, or whether it's humanity, economically, politically, socially, racially. And when things get out of balance or are stirred, it's a crisis. And the desire is, can we get back to calm? Can we get back to a time or an experience when everything was balanced? Is this familiar? It's not rocket science, is it? Okay. So, stability and calm. And politicians will often offer some variations on that. When things are stable and calm, we know what to expect, and that helps most people relax. Heart rate goes down. There's space and energy for humor and for just to be. Now, I say most people because there are some people who never seem to be able to relax. So they have a turmoil inside them that they're always anxious, even when all around them is calm. Chronic anxiety. So this morning, we see Moses and the pilgrim people on this 40-year journey. It's one episode. And they're living as nomads in the wilderness, in the dry places with their animals. And having recently been to that part of the world, I know droughts, but I've never seen anything as arid as the region around the Jordan or the desert. It is bleached dry in places. The contrast between where there is water and where there is not water is so dramatic. I couldn't have anticipated it before I saw it. And this leads them to run into one of those many moments in the Exodus journey. I'm going to go through this. So the text is up on the screen. You may have it there too. So we're in Exodus 17. All the congregation of the people of Israel moved on from the wilderness of Sin. Now, Sin is just a name. It's not falling short of the glory of God. It's not trying to be allegorical. And they moved on by stages according to the commandment of the Lord. So far, so good. And they camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. So they find themselves without water. 4 days without water, apparently, and most of us keel over. Our bodies need water. Time was running out. People get thirsty. People got anxious. People get angry. The range of emotions starts to roll. This is how revolutions happen. Russia, France, various places. On certain days, it just tips. It's why the French law requires there always to be bread available in every town. The boulangerie is not just a sort of a quaint custom. No, it's strategic. There must be bread available. Because if there's not, we might have another revolution. And with all that that brings. So here's my first question. God is leading them along. They camp and they run out of water. Didn't God know this? Was this bad management by the Almighty? Well, it's a valid question, isn't it? And we read in verse 1, the people of Israel moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages according to the commandment of the Lord. And they camped. How could they be led by God and have landed in a place without water? Wouldn't it be great if a 10-year-old asked you that? Eva, what are the options? And you may have another option because you're clever people. God had it wrong that day. God was trying to kill them. It was a test of faith. Or Moses had messed up. Any other options? So as you're sitting there in the Judean or the wilderness heat, wasn't necessarily Judea, but it was on that journey, and it's well over 30, probably between 30 and 40, and your tongue starts to stick, and you're getting thirsty, and you're watching your little ones and elderly sort of go faint, and your animals are complaining. These theological questions may press hard. So without water, we have lost homeostasis and we are sliding into crisis mode. We read on in verse 2. Therefore, as if it's a logical consequence, the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." There's something disconnected here. You spot it? The Lord leads them. They're following the Lord. It goes south, as we say. There's a problem. So they quarrel with Moses. So, if there's a problem, you take it up with administration, with management, or leadership. Let them know that you're unhappy, even if the Lord is leading you. Double, isn't it? So they did not take it up with God, who had been their saving power so far, who'd taken them out of Egypt, who'd rescued them at the Dead Sea, who'd, I don't know of the sequence, but you know, would provide manna, who would get them out of all sorts of sticky situations. Now they're in a sticky situation. Take it to Moses. How come? This is where we see Moses as a good shepherd. He's admired throughout the Bible, but this is just one thing that starts to happen here. A bad shepherd at this point would say, would give up and run. I've had it with this lot. I'm out of here. No. Advertise and hire. Get someone else. The sheep are revolting. I'm worth more than this. Why should I take this? I'm fed up with being bitten. God, I quit. You can have your people. Now, there are plenty of indications that throughout this Exodus journey, Moses felt that. He's moving in. He is among the people. He's close to them. He's not on some top level of a corporate structure, you know, sending down thunderbolts to people on the floors below. He's in amongst it. They're close to him. They know where he lives. And he is also feeling the thirst. First thing he does, by the way, as his role was to represent God to the people and the people to God. He was the middleman, big time. And that's a difficult place to be, because if people are unhappy with God, they take it out on him. If God is unhappy with the people, God lets Moses know. So we read, and in verse 2, and Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water, and the people grumbled against Moses and said, "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" You know, God and Moses, there's like a split vision going on. It's like my computer at home where I have two screens. I can look down, I can look up. And what does Moses try to do? He tries to turn their attention, because that's what leaders do. People are looking this way, get them to look that way. It's not sneaky, it's good practice. He tries to turn their attention to the Lord, who is the big player in the drama. The Lord is the biggest reality in this whole situation. And he does what he must do as the man between God and the people. So we read in verse 4. So, Moses cried to the Lord, "What shall I do with these people? They're almost ready to stone me." And he, in response to this, the Lord gives them a whole set of instructions. "Go ahead of the people," I heard the reading this morning. "Pass on before the people. Take some of the elders. Move ahead. There's a rock. Hit it with that stick that you used at the Nile, and water will come out of it." So there are instructions given by God to supply water. So water's provided, the people drink, anxiety drops, everyone is happy. Good story. In the last line of this, in verse 7, we read Moses' own reflection on the whole experience, which answers the question, what was this all about? Why did this happen? Going back to those questions earlier on, you know, did God miss a beat? Or did Moses not hear rightly? Was this management failure? Was this systemic failure or what? Why did God lead us into this? And Moses' perspective is, they tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? That's his description of what this was all about. A few thirsty days in the desert, but actually, the all-important, significant thing that was happening was this was the people questioning, is God really with us? Or are we chasing our tails out here in the wilderness with this guy who thinks he hears from heaven? So, can we recognize ourselves, past or present, in this story? Is there anywhere where you have been in this? Has there ever been a church situation where you're in that sort of situation? The value of crisis and chaos is that it reveals what is actually there. What the actual operating values are, what people actually believe, what's actually considered real. That only comes out under crisis. I went to a school which had a boarding division. That means 200 of the 700 boys at the school that I was at stayed. They lodged there. And so for 5 years I was in a school of 700 boys. It was a very male knock-on situation. One night in the boarding house, someone tripped over a washing basket, and as they fell, they hit the fire alarm. And so the alarms went off. And people flushed out from rooms everywhere, carrying their precious possessions down these stairwells, these fire escapes, and everything was revealed. So at the time, I was part of the school newspaper. And so we were very interested to know in the stories, what happened that night? That night when everyone thought the building was coming down, what did people actually do? Well, there was one, because it was a school run by the Marist fathers, there was one priest who was seen descending the flight of stairs with his goldfish bowl. We thought that was very funny. Okay, so schoolboys, the thought of Father so-and-so, his prized possession was his goldfish bowl, and he was coming down the stairs. There were people carrying contraband. There were people carrying all sorts of things. There were even one or two people flushed out of spaces who shouldn't be there. So crisis brings revelation at times. It reveals things that otherwise you'd never see. And here's the funny thing. We remember when the pressure was on, what did so-and-so do? Where did they go? What was their response when homeostasis disappeared in an instant? The value of these crises. What treasures do we grab? How do people behave? Here we are, we're at the beginning of something that could get quite intense. Watch. Watch. This is going to be a season of revelation. Watch what happens. Who says what when the pressure is on? Not about judging. It's about seeing what's actually there all the time, but is not on display. In any crisis, the fearful start yelling, and you can start to hear the mill winding up. I'm not thinking about our church so much, but particularly in relation to anxiety around COVID-19. So for myself, as a leader, I listen to what people have to say. But the problem is the first person to speak are the anxious. They're always at the head of the queue. Now listen, but understand what's driving this. And fear is not a good advocate. Fear is not a good advisor. More than that, my role is to lead people in faith, not in fear. So as with the crisis, the fearful start yelling at the leadership. Moses had that. Normal standard procedure. In extreme cases, they even will attack the leader as if that will change something. So to help us help the fearful to be strong, loving, and wise in a crisis, I want to give a few points, note a few things. The engine of fear is doubt. Stock markets are telling us that all the time. When there's homeostasis, people make confident choices and decisions. When there's chaos or unpredictability, there's doubt, double-mindedness. And even though it doesn't work this way physiologically, our brain has two halves. It's as if the two are going bang, bang, bang. Instead of being one mind, there is a storm in there. That is the engine of anxiety, of fear. And it's seen in some practical ways, and I'm going to get a bit clinical here. The first is, I want to suggest there's something called fusion. I've spoken to some of you about this. But it's the person who is aware of everybody else, is taking in all the information, but hasn't worked it out for themselves. So they're constantly in response mode. So-and-so is saying that, so-and-so is saying that, so-and-so is saying that. Do you know that this has been said? And if you take a position, when they're really wound up, they'll say, yes, but over here. So there is a time to be open and take in all the information. But if you stay in that mode, and if you are just responding constantly to the last piece of information you've been given, that's an engine of fear. So it's one of the functions of leadership is to not go there. To be clear, to be defined, make a choice, maybe the wrong choice. But if you make a choice, you step out of that engine of fear. Information is important, but it doesn't provide courage or wisdom. And it's a matter of negotiation or navigating that step from taking in information to taking a position, to taking a stance. Now, so Moses had it. Jesus had it too. Can you think of instances where people turned on Jesus? Storm in the boat. We're drowning. And then they said, don't you care? It's classic. Classic. Can you imagine Jesus being uncaring? And yet, it's not because he was uncaring, it's because he was so relaxed, he was asleep. He's totally laid back, as we'd say in New Zealand. But his being calm, his being at peace, troubled those who were thinking they were in their last minutes. So, when you hear things like, don't you care, it's the person who can't come to composure themselves, latches on to someone else as if I deal with him or her, then somehow I improve the situation. It's standard human behavior. This is life on the farm. It can be heard in projection. So again, don't you care? It's people attributing thoughts, feelings, motivations, conspiracies, So this week I've heard, for example, well, the Dutch government are just doing this because they have this agenda, or because of the economy, because of that. BBC does it all the time. It seems to be standard practice there. They report someone and then they say, he's saying this because. How do you know? Okay. So, the engine of fear is doubt or double-mindedness, and it exhibits in those sorts of behaviors. So I'm saying to you, don't go there. And if you find people around you going there, calm them down. Love, power, and a sound mind. Okay, the way of wisdom is to go to, the second point is, the way of wisdom is to go to the greatest reality. The greatest reality. Who matters or what matters in the situation? The critical reality, you might say in our modern language. Moses gets there in verse 4. Moses cried to the Lord. I don't know what's happening, but God is there and God's big and God's real. Now, this is where we come in the frame. This is what we do as Christians. As God's people, we go to the Lord. That doesn't mean denying everything else, but you go to the biggest reality. That's the wisdom we follow. We go to the biggest rock, the source of life. Go to the one in whom we are baptized. Go to the one in whom we live and move and have our being. We sing the songs, we pray the prayers, we wear the t-shirts. When the crisis comes, do it. And that's part of my motivation for being here this morning. Otherwise, it's just farm management. Okay. So, the desert journey that Israel was on, or the people of Israel were on, later Jeremiah would speak for the Lord and say, that was our honeymoon. I took you away to lonely, deserted places, Israel. Why? What do you do on a honeymoon? Tender days of relating, intimacy, just me and thee. But what was actually going on this honeymoon was there was storm, there was crisis, there was a tempestuous honeymoon. And yet Yahweh speaks through Jeremiah to say, I treasure those days. We were relating. We were learning how to relate. It's why these stories are so precious, because they are stories from the honeymoon that God's people can always look back to and say, we learned something there, we learned something there. Oh, we're learning it again. So, there are cool-headed pragmatists in this and everywhere. You could step back from the story and say, it's about water. All this relational stuff is beside the point. It's about water. Moses, get out there and drill. Scout. Go ahead. Find water, Moses. Just that's all you have to do, and everything goes away. But that's not the point. The point is about building a relationship. The number of times I have been told, after there's a little bit of excitement in the camp, if you'd managed it this and this and this way, that wouldn't have happened. And I've listened to that, and I found that very interesting. But then I thought afterwards, if I'd managed it this and this and this way, I'd never have realized what the reality was. You can be so good at managing things, you can be so good at maintaining, being pragmatic about solving the potential problems, that the relationship never gets exercised. So, the crisis was the lesson. Simply solving the crisis of the day, being water or COVID-19, is not the issue. The issue is, how are we related to this? And Jesus spoke about this several times. The most striking one is when there were innocent casualties of Pilate, who had people knifed while they were going about shopping, or a tower that fell on people. And he pointed and said, look, the real issue is, where did they stand with God? Not that their life was brutally ended. That's sad. It's a different perspective. So, it's a lesson that we need reinforcing again and again. And COVID-19 is just another example. It's an exercise in faith over fear. So just to come into land, I thought to offer a few words about the civil authorities. We're watching very closely to what they say, and we're in compliance with their instructions here this morning. The Christian view on government is that government is there to promote good and restrain evil. I'll unpack that some other day. To promote good and restrain evil. That's what good government does. And we are to respect them in that and to cooperate. And I think they're doing their job. I'm not going to assess it, but that's happening. But there is a but. And it tends to happen, even with Christian political parties, it tends to happen in our world within a secular box. So I've just said that Moses modeled something for us. He went to the greatest reality, God. People who live in the secular box do precisely not that. Not that. All I'm saying is we have a different frame of reference. So all the messaging we're getting this week, God is not part of the equation. Faith is not part of the equation. It's reduced to numbers that every educated Dutch person can follow. And that's okay. We live as exiles among the nations. The point is, that secular box is not our box. As people with faith in God, God as the biggest living reality, living among non-believers in a time of crisis and fear, we need to be wise. So we're to be people of prudence and faith. We're washing our hands. We are keeping distance. You know, the call for social distance. We're doing that. We're not shaking hands. We're sitting in this church like gas molecules with distance between us. Prudence and faith. We are to live with wisdom and risk. John Wimber, big noise at the end of last century. How do you spell faith? R-I-S-K. It's an adult message, but one of the craziest terms we have, well, a term that really needs unpacking, is safe sex. Never safe. It's always charged with risk. Life is risk. Get out your door, go to work, go shopping. There's risk. You can't step back from it. And yet when fear and anxiety rises, it's like all risk becomes black, becomes bad. We are people to live with wisdom and risk. Life means risk. It can't be avoided. So prudence and faith, wisdom and risk, safety and integrity. Be true to who you are. Be true to who you are in God, and yet be as safe as possible. So don't be afraid. Look to God as our life before we look to people. And that's what the conversation with the woman at the well was all about, which is another sermon. Jesus is walking her through. She keeps going to people issues and tradition issues, and Jesus is taking her through to the water that only God can give. Look to God as our life before we look to people. Cooperate with the government and live wisely. I hope this is helpful. I'd like to lead us in prayer now, and we're a small group. Please, let's pray together. Pray as people of faith in uncertain times.